Welcome to the Bunch UK podcast. You're greeted by me, Davey.
And I'm Tony.
I'm Alan.
And I'm Simon.
This show brings us
an interview with Ian Oswald from showmedo.com,
Graham Bleach from Hanslug,
and Mark Shuttleworth.
Okay, my body clock is telling me it's 3 o'clock in the morning. What a perfect time to do a podcast. Let's get on with it.
Right, we spoke about screencasts previously, and for this podcast, we've got Ian Oswald in from showmedo.com.
Yes, thanks for having me along.
Tell me about showmedo.com. What is it all about?
So showmedo is an educational video site. You can think of us as a YouTube for education, and we show screencasts. So we only show screencasts, no granny falls off a log videos. and the whole point of the site is that we realised that we really enjoyed teaching people, my partner and I, Karen, how to use software, but you have to have us in the room to show you how to use the software. And we figured that if there was a video site which showed you how to use software, we could teach people around the world. And there wasn't one, so we set about building it, and that became ShowMeDo 2.5 years ago.
Fantastic. Being that you're on an Ubuntu podcast, we assume you have Ubuntu videos, mm-hmm. on there.
Yep. We've got over 500 screencasts in the site. Wow. Around 50 of those are to do with Linux, and the majority show Ubuntu in action. A couple recently show some other derivations of Linux, but for the most part, we've got videos showing how to use applications like OpenOffice and Inkscape and programming languages like Python inside Ubuntu. And so we've got authors there contributing just these various topics and showing Ubuntu in action.
Excellent. And what do I need if I want to go to the site and view them? Do I need to sign up or anything like that?
No, you can just turn up to the site cold from Google. And as long as you've got a flash player installed, so you could watch videos on any other video site on the web, then you'll be able to watch our videos as well, and they'll just stream straight down.
And you have to use the, at the moment, you have to use the Adobe.
Yes, you need the Ubuntu flash plugin. Yeah. The Gnash one conflicts with the video player that we use, so we can't use that at the moment.
Right, okay, but they're working on that, I understand.
Yes, I understand that there are improvements being made there. And for users that don't like that, you can also download the videos and watch them offline.
What format do they come down in?
So the videos, when you download them, they come down as flash video, they're .flv ending, and you can watch that with VideoLAN client or mPlayer or any of the standard media players on Ubuntu.
So of the 500 videos on the site, have you and your partner created them all?
Oh, no. So I've created almost 100 of them in the 2.5 years that we've been going, but 400 have been contributed by 70 authors, and they're all open source authors, people who have knowledge and like to share it, and then they found us and they realised they could demonstrate their skills to a worldwide audience, and so they put aside their time, make the videos, and then we just help teach the world how to use software.
And how do they make the videos?
So you can use open source screencasting software. All you need is a microphone, and half of our authors use the built-in mic on their laptops. Anyone who's got a microphone built into their laptop with some open source software like Record My Desktop, and we've got videos showing you how to use that on Ubuntu, can sit back and in the space of a couple of hours start making screencasts. It's interesting because we've grown this huge audience, and we've never actually actively advertised. I've tried a little dabble with Google AdSense, but aside from that, we just it's just word of mouth. Our videos are good, people talk about them, and we get a large audience.
What are the ones that people seem to clamour for and ask you for?
It's a lot of beginner videos. How do I start using X? Out of all the different topics that we've covered, it's the beginner videos. How do I start writing my first GUI application? How do I install the software and then write my first Hello World GUI tool? Or how do I start, or certainly on the Ubuntu ones, how do I use OpenOffice to write a letter and to configure printing and to configure the letter?
Are you looking at coordinating the content that you're providing, aiming at specific areas, specific bits of software, or is it just people thinking, you know, for example, I'd like to make one on IRSSI, the IRC client? Mm-hmm. Are you after anything specific, or just, you know, people make their videos and put them on and that's it?
People make the videos in their own time for free. They're giving back to the community, and so we encourage our authors to just make videos on the topics that that they enjoy and they know the most about and they want to share with the world. So we don't ask anyone to actively focus on certain topics. If you know something and you want to share it, and certainly if you've taught other people that topic before, that's a fantastic area for you to make screencasts in.
So I provide a video file with sound. How do I get that to you?
So you log into ShowMeDo, and then you get a tab for My Page. It's very much like YouTube. You go into My Page and you can add video, and then in there you add some details. You put in a title, a couple of paragraph description, some tags. You upload the video file. It takes maybe half an hour for the video to upload, and then our servers process it, and then it's ready half an hour later. One thing to add is that unlike YouTube and other video sites, we preview all the material that comes through. We're incredibly careful that we only want educational material so people can trust in us, and we're absolutely not an unfiltered video site. So everything comes in, we get notified, and then within 24 hours we will have seen the video and then given any feedback if it was necessary. But for the most part, videos come in, we look at them, we're hugely impressed, and we publish them.
So if you're having all this bandwidth usage and all these people viewing the site and viewing the videos, how do you pay for all that?
It comes out of our own pocket. It's starting a video-based startup is a very... It's an easy proposition if you think about what you're trying to deliver. So we run this out of our own investment, and then before Christmas we decided to build up the ShowMeDo Club, and the club is a subscription-based club. It's a bit like subscribing to a magazine, and there, rather than produce videos in an ad hoc manner on topics that we thought were interesting, we instead decided to focus on producing a very clear and focused series about half hour in length each, starting with Python, teaching beginners how to program Python. And so that's it's a club containing all the material you're going to need over time to learn the language. And once we've established that club, it's growing very nicely at the moment, then we're going to spread out into other areas. And I imagine that Ubuntu would come into the club, because that's an obvious large open source area that we'd love to support.
What is it specifically about educational videos that attracted you to start working on this project? Have you done anything in the educational field before?
Both Kieran and I are long-term academics, Kieran much more so than me, and we are driven by learning. We love to learn, we love to share what we've learned. We know that when you pick up a book, you often don't know if what you're reading about will solve your problem, certainly with computer manuals. But if you can see if you can see a video showing you how something works, you can look at it, and you can pay half attention first of all, watching what's happening, and when you see that your problem has been solved, you can go back and watch it again, because you know this is exactly what you need to solve your own problem. And we just figured that video was a very efficient medium for getting across the message, not only that you can do this, but here are exactly all of the steps that you need. Even if a new version of a GUI comes out and the menus are in a different place, you can still follow the gist of the video much more so than you can in a book when material goes out of date.
That's quite a good point, because things like screencasts do get out of date when the next version of distribution comes out. The artwork changes, the menu locations. Although some people will be able to follow through and sort of guess, there'll be equally another set of people for whom they will be totally thrown by a different menu structure. It's a lot of maintenance to keep those screencasts up to date. Is that something that the community shoulders, or do you try and keep on top of that? Or?
At the moment, because we're 2.5 years old, most of the content, or in fact almost all of the content, is up to date. I found some of my earliest videos, I've now deprecated them, and they're in the site, but they're marked as being deprecated. I would say perhaps 5 out of 500 videos are deprecated at the moment, so I'm not worried about the issue of material going out of date. As the content base grows, then that will become an increasing problem, but that's one for the future. That'll be a nice problem to have.
Are all of your videos in English?
Interesting question. So when we started, we assumed that everything would be in English, and then it didn't take us very long to find a couple of European authors, one in Belgium and one in Germany, and they both wanted to produce content in their own home languages, which in both cases were German. And so we have a mostly English content base with some German videos, and then just recently, via a European school, we've now got Russian and Chinese, I think Spanish videos coming as well, but certainly Russian and Chinese at the moment.
So does that mean you're going to have to, or if you already have, internationalised the ShowMeDo interface as well?
Well, we're Unicoded, but the main language is English throughout the site, but descriptions and titles are in the home language.
So related to that, there's also the topic of subtitles. Do you include those, or have you considered including them?
Yes, so we have considered including them. We had a problem with the player, sort of a technical issue, when we first looked at the problem, and so we chose not to worry about encoding subtitles. For our foreign language videos, the authors typically hard code English subtitles, so you can read the English subtitles whilst listening to the foreign voice.
When you say hard code, you mean actually on the video
itself?
It's
part of the video stream, yes.
Right, okay.
Yep.
In your wildest dreams, mm-hmm. what do you see Show Me Do becoming in the future?
Becoming a huge educational resource, which everyone can call upon. We'd love to have stacks and stacks of free content, and we'd love to go beyond video as well. We've even thought about having interactive educational sessions, almost classrooms online, teaching people around the world. And if we have the support that we need to grow our side of the business so that we can work in it full time, then we can keep growing the free side of the business.
So where can people get more information?
Come to showmedo.com. There's a resources menu on the navigation bar. You can find out the author's discussion forum and the learner's discussion forum. So you can come there to talk to us. And if you log into the site, then you'll be on the mailing list and you hear more from me every month. And we'd just love you to come and get involved, have a look at the videos, realise how easy it is to make screencasts yourself, and then have a go at making your own and contributing back to the community.
Great stuff. We've been given some prizes to give away on the show.
Have we?
Yes.
What have we been given?
We've been given some tokens for the Canonical online store.
Cool. There's some good stuff in there. How are we going to get rid of these tokens?
We figured we'd have a trivia question. So we'll ask a trivia question this week, and then in 2 weeks' time, when we record the next episode, which will be the 3rd of May, we'll go through all the answers we've been sent and pick a winner.
From the hat.
In fact, we'll ask Mark Shuttleworth to pick the winner for us.
Wow.
We'll email the voucher to the winner.
Excellent. So Canonical employees and those of us sitting in this room recording the podcast sadly can't enter, because that wouldn't be fair.
Yeah, but anyone else listening to the show can enter. The way they enter is I'll read out a question in a minute, and you send your answer to competition@ubuntu-uk.org. That's competition@ubuntu-uk.org, and it needs to get here before the 3rd of May.
A link to that will be in the show notes.
Cool. So, what's the question?
The question is, what's the name of the free software only official derivative of Ubuntu? What is the name of the free software only official derivative of Ubuntu?
Good luck, everybody.
Now, last week we mentioned about a certain hacking competition which happened where Ubuntu appeared to come out on top. Following that, we had Graham Bleach contact us. So I've got Graham here who wants to talk about Unix malware. Hello, Graham.
Hiya. So I was interested in the segment, and I thought that there'd been a lot of interesting publicity coming out of that competition, where there were three laptops which were available for people to try and break into. And at the end of the three-day competition, only the Ubuntu one hadn't been hacked. And I thought it was quite interesting because a lot of people, mentioning no names, Popey, seemed to be kind of forming the impression that this proved that somehow Linux was more secure than the other OSs. And I don't necessarily think that's the case.
Why is that then?
What you've got to remember is it's a hacking competition where people try and win some money in return for showing a zero-day exploit. And the interesting thing about it was that the Mac machine went down first, due to a bug in Safari, and then secondly the Windows machine went down due to a bug in Flash. And the first day was it had to be a remote vulnerability, and on the second day of the competition they were allowed to actually navigate the browser to a website that they'd crafted, which exploited the browser. And on the third day they were allowed to install common applications such as Flash, for example. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing was that Vista did very well, I thought, in the competition, because it was only when they installed some Adobe software on it that they could actually compromise it. I was thinking that perhaps, you know, if you install some common applications, Linux would be just as vulnerable as the other OSs.
But why was that not the case? Why did people still go for the Mac and for the Vista box over the Ubuntu box, even when they had the opportunity to install those things?
Well, the frustrating thing is we don't really know, and this is why it isn't really telling us much about the security of the platforms, because we don't know how many people actually had a go at the Ubuntu laptop and what sort of security backgrounds they had. So it doesn't really tell us anything, I think, is what I'm saying.
But is system security always a case of not being totally uncrackable? Nothing is totally uncrackable. It's just a case of being tougher than the other people, so the people go after the easier targets, which is usually the Windows PC or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair enough. But I think the point I've been trying to make is that people in the Linux and Unix communities do seem to have an attitude that something about the platform makes us more secure, so we don't have to worry about viruses, is what I hear people say all the time. And there are Linux viruses in the world, they're just not very common.
So are you saying that the community could potentially be looking into getting a false sense of security over this? If that's the case, how can we avoid this?
We are lulling ourselves into a bit of a false sense of security, yes, because, I mean, how many of us would consider running a Windows box without a virus scanner? But how many of us would consider running a Linux box without a virus scanner? And I think many more of us would be happy running, say, Ubuntu install with no virus scanner. I know I do it myself, and I know many other people do it, whereas we wouldn't do the same thing on a Windows box.
What should we be doing with our Linux machines to make them as secure as, well, this sounds wrong, but as secure as a Windows machine that has all the relevant patches and the antivirus and the firewall and the malware detection and all that kind of stuff?
I think it's not so much what we should be doing, because I think most, at the moment, we're in a situation where most Linux users, most users of, for example, Ubuntu and Debian and things like that, they're fairly cautious people anyway, and they tend to be quite highly skilled. But certainly these days, you're attracting more of a different user profile onto the platform. And I think any increase in popularity and any increase in the number of less experienced users will perhaps make Ubuntu or Linux in general a more attractive target. So perhaps one of the things you might consider doing is, in the same way that Ubuntu ships with automatic updates and other things ship with automatic updates turned on, virus scanning should be integrated into your email client, and the updates for virus scanning should be turned on by default.
A lot of people who migrate from Windows to Linux, one of the first questions they ask is, where do I get the antivirus software? Because they're so used to it, it's drummed into them that on Windows you absolutely need an antivirus product.
One thing I'm particularly pleased to see with the new Ubuntu Hardy release, they are actually shipping a firewall. And I think it's great, because previously there was an ethos going around the community that it wasn't required because there was no services switched on by default.
So there was nothing listening,
yeah,
nothing opening connection.
Yeah, well, of course there is outbound stuff happening. Mm. But yeah, so I'm quite pleased to see the new distribution, the long-term release as well, is actually going to have a firewall built in.
Well, arguably, it's always had a firewall, because IPTables is part of the Linux kernel. So it's just a case of configuring it.
Is this just a new GUI for configuring the firewall?
Yeah, actually, it's not a GUI, it's a command line. It's called Uncomplicated Firewall.
I think one of the things there is, are they going to actually deal with the problem of, I installed my Skype and now it doesn't work in a sensible way, and, you know, that sort of usability problem that leads people to just turning the thing off.
Yeah. Mm. Which is exactly what Windows users do, although a lot of the Mickey Mouse desktop software firewalls that people use have, you know, Skype is trying to make a call, would you like to allow this, and allow it permanently, and they just go yes, and that's it.
The difficulty is people then get into the habit of saying yes to anything that pops up, because they say no to something and it doesn't work, they're put off from saying no to things in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And when an email client spawns a child, you know, nasty process, and then the firewall pops up and says your email is trying to contact, you know, they'll let it through. Yeah, sure. And are we going to get to that same point with Ubuntu if we add these protection measures like antivirus and then a graphical firewall? Aren't we just going to lead our users down the same path of just ticking yes on every dialogue?
And this is the same sort of thing that Fedora users have had with SE Linux, in that it's designed to restrict what applications can do, whether they can open ports, what they can address, what devices they can use, things like that. But because it was so complex in the past to get up and running, one of the most frequently asked questions about Fedora was, how do you turn SE Linux off? and now AppArmor is in Ubuntu now, and I don't know whether I don't think it's on by default. But I mean, things like that seem to be very appropriate tools for stopping things like malware on Unix if it was to, you know, propagate. But because they're so complex to manage, people will just turn them off or ignore them and live with the risk.
But what is the risk? I mean, this is one of the things that's always spoken about in these discussions, is if, as a user on my Linux system, I get a virus and a Linux virus and I get infected. Well, so what? I've just infected that one user. I delete the user, make a new user, carry on.
But what's the most important thing on your computer?
It's your data.
In your home directory, and you have rights to change that. Therefore, any program that you run has rights to change and corrupt and delete it. So whilst you're not, you may well get to a situation where you install something or you run something that can't propagate itself because it can't install itself as a service and run itself over and over again every time you boot the machine up. It can completely hose all of your data or pick up all of your passwords from your instant messenger or, you know, and email those out to someone else.
The most important thing on my system is my data. It's my photographs, my documents, whatever. Obviously, I'm a sensible user and I run backups. If my system was compromised, half an hour with an Ubuntu CD, I can have a base install backup. Another hour, perhaps installing a few additional applications on there. Getting my photographs back, if I've not backed those up, is impossible.
What about wider-reaching things? You know, viruses that are going to try and do system-level damage. Now, obviously, you need root permissions to do that.
No, you don't really, because you can elevate with tools like sudo.
Yeah, it's trying to get out of people's way when they're doing administrative tasks. So they have, 30 minutes or 15 minutes of potential to use sudo to escalate your privileges. If I were theoretically to try and write some malware to target Linux users, the first thing I would do is try and run something through sudo to see if I could.
Yeah, and schedule it to run every 15 minutes as a user-based cron job.
Yeah, exactly. You just loop in the background and wait until the sudo privilege is available.
Obviously, for listeners who don't know, who we've just babbled on about sudo, when you go in Ubuntu, when you go to system administration, anything under that menu requires administrative access. So that invokes sudo, which escalates your privileges. And there are other commands you can run using sudo. There's no way for you to press a button in GNOME or in Ubuntu to say, kill my sudo privileges, I want to no longer have that timestamp. But, I mean, you could create a shortcut.
If listeners are aware of a way of doing that.
Yeah, email in if we're all completely wrong, especially Graham.
Yeah.
Okay, we've spoken about most things. What about untrusted software? I've just downloaded a rather nice program for downloading GPS software, but it's from an untrusted source. Should I be worried? What should I be worried about with untrusted packages?
Define trusted.
Well, if you've got the GPG key, then apt won't moan, and as far as you're concerned, it's a trusted source.
Yeah, but I mean, how do we actually believe that the Ubuntu and the Debian developers are actually auditing the source code to make sure there's nothing dodgy in there? I don't believe that. What the GPG key tells us is that the package matches what was uploaded by the developer. It doesn't really tell us whether the software is safe or not.
But isn't that the developer's job? Can developers reasonably be expected to audit code for security? Now, it does happen. You know, you get Apache and SSH and things like that where, you know, they do quite tight security code audits. There's probably, you know, 100 applications for every one that's heavily audited that isn't. And developers just sort of take the source code from the original site, package it up, tweak it for the Debian packaging guidelines, and off they go.
I think it's a bit unreasonable to expect a Debian developer or a master of the universe for the Ubuntu Universe repository for them to actually know some of the software inside out to be able to see security issues.
And we know that people have tried to, for example, introduce a backdoor into the Linux kernel, and, you know, I think there's a famous case a while ago where TCP wrappers was compromised for several months, and they simply broken in, installed a backdoor, and watched as people downloaded it.
So if we've got our security heads on, then really we can't trust anything. And so how do we keep a check on our systems, or how do we watch to make sure that something untoward isn't going on? You know, what can I do to make sure that my system isn't emailing passwords and things back out to somebody on the other side of my firewall?
Well, part of that would be having a decent firewall.
Outbound as well, checking.
Outbound as well.
Because most people only do NAT as a firewall, and that's checking inbound only.
It's who you trust. I have to trust
trust Canonical and the Ubuntu teams that they do a job of packaging the core applications. I have to trust that Linus and his team can develop the kernel properly. I have to trust the OpenSSH team that they do a good job. I'm not a programmer. I couldn't start to sit down and look at the source code for all these applications, let alone understand what the implications of every single line and every single function might be to say, yes, this is written in a reasonably sane way. And no matter how good they are, there's always going to be security vulnerabilities. You just got to say, put your faith in certain groups or certain bodies or certain organizations and just say, I'm going to trust you with the security of my system. And the question you've got to ask as a user, I think, is do you trust Canonical and those people over, say, Microsoft or Apple?
But, I mean, Launchpad now makes it really easy for you to package and actually have your own repository on Launchpad. And it's called PPAs, which is Personal Package Archive. I think we talked about them before.
Yeah.
Now, I'm actually quite surprised we haven't actually had more problems with malicious software going into them. Because the thing is, I mean, I could package something up which would potentially have something harmful in there. I'm surprised we haven't had more problems with that.
Maybe as the platform becomes more popular, we will, as Graham says. You know, part of the reason why this isn't happening is because we don't have the mass of people using it.
So it's safe to assume, actually, that we shouldn't be complacent. Just because you're running Linux doesn't mean it's secure. I know that there are loads of experts out there, and I really hope that we're going to get stacks of feedback about this. I'd like to see what people are doing to secure their systems. Let us know.
I've been away for a couple of weeks and I've not been on the internet very much. I've missed all the news. What's been going on?
Red Hat have pulled out of the desktop Linux market.
Again? Did they ever actually enter it? So what does this mean for Fedora?
Who cares?
MySQL have announced that in the enterprise version there's going to be some proprietary components that won't be in the community edition.
That's Sun getting open source again then.
Yeah, so a Sun evil? There's a new feature on the Hardy CD that's recently been introduced. It allows you to install a free software-only desktop.
Isn't that what Gubuntu does?
Yes, but it's not as free as Gubuntu.
It's only a bit free.
So are you telling me that I get the normal Ubuntu desktop, the only difference is that I can't use my wireless?
Related to that, on the Gubuntu developer mailing list, there's currently a lengthy discussion kicked off by Mark Shuttleworth rethinking Gubuntu and its relationship with the community and its relationship with the GNU Sense distribution.
Does it have a relationship with the community?
Ubuntu 8.04 long-term support has been released on Thursday, the 24th of April.
On the same day as the Hardy release, there's a Hardy release party. There's one in London at Dehem in Soho. From the 16th of May for a week, there is two events, FOSCamp, and then followed by the Ubuntu Developer Summit.
And where is that?
Prague.
There's also Ubuntu Live coming up in July 21st and 22nd at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland, Oregon, America.
We have Mark Shuttleworth on the line. Hello, Mark.
Hi there. How are you guys?
Not bad at all. We wanted to get you on to have a little chat about Ubuntu in the UK, and we wanted to ask you a few questions. We've got a new release coming up, Hardy.
Which I'm sure he actually knows about.
Yeah, I think Mark's aware of that. How are things going from your side of the fence?
Well, this is clearly our most significant release ever. As a community, I think more people would have contributed to this release, and more people will have very high expectations of this release. So the anticipation is running very high. Indications are all very good. We put a release candidate out. The feedback has been very positive throughout the beta program, and we fully expect to hit the release date of the 24th. So it's very exciting. Yeah. We've got a lot of companies and a lot of other communities around the world that are watching to see how we do.
Yeah, the release tends to go a bit mad, really, doesn't it? Your servers take a bit of a hammering. A lot of people jump on IRC, and we have parties all over the place.
Yeah, it's time for celebration. It's kind of the culmination of an intense 6 months. And an opportunity to blow off some steam. I think we'll be putting out 14 gigabits per second of Ubuntu from London, and then there'll probably be about another 10 gigabits going out from other mirrors around the world. We have a fantastic mirror network of about 200 mirrors that will all be fully up to speed. So it's going to be a big day.
Yeah, it's
a
phenomenal amount of traffic you push, but people, you know, just seem so eager to get hold of it. I know, you know, we're all Ubuntu fans, so we're going to be, you know, we're going to be jumping on the mirrors and grabbing it.
Well, have you guys been running the beta through the course of development, or do you tend to sort of wait for the release and then upgrade?
Yeah, I guess it depends. Sometimes, I mean, personally, I run it on a couple of machines and then just do the incremental updates. So there's little for me to do on the end.
Yeah, but for folks who install the beta or the release candidates, it's a relatively small update usually to the final, and it's a way to get ahead of the insane rush. But then there's also something to be said for waiting till the green light and downloading the final images.
I mean, one thing I've found is where I've been running it for quite a while now, the changes have been so incremental that I'm not going to see a big difference. Now, if I suddenly changed over on release day, I would be really excited of all the changes we're having. Sort of wish maybe I had waited for the green light now.
Yeah, if you go back, if you have a machine which is running sort of an older version, Feisty, Gutsy, and do the update there, then you suddenly realise just how much happens in a six-month cycle. It's incredible.
Well, now this is an LTS release. There's clearly going to be some people who are upgrading from Dapper, so there's going to be a major change for them.
Mm. It's really impressive to me that the guys have managed to make that a smooth upgrade. In part, I think that's credit to the Debian community, right? The underpinnings of Ubuntu in Debian are so rigorously well designed that it makes that kind of thing possible. So we should give credit to them for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so there's a whole bunch of release parties on the day, and I guess you guys would be able to point people at the wiki, but I believe there are at least one, possibly two release parties happening in London. And so I thought it would be a good thing to invite folks to get on the wiki, take a look at those, and come and join us on the day.
Yeah, Canonical are having one, is that right?
Yeah, well, we've organized one in Soho at De Hem, and then there's a bit of a tradition of one at the Pembury as well that some folks go to. I think it's one of the few bars in London that has a history of Ubuntu parties and a pool table, and I think they have bandwidth.
Yeah, they last time I think they organized to have a mirror of the ISO images, so that if you wanted to have beer and ISO.
That would be the only Ubuntu mirror in a pub, but...
that's some accolade to have. Actually, I remember the Gutsy party when you turned up and were giving me instructions over my shoulder to help someone get wireless enabled on their IBM laptop, and I think... I don't know how many people have been able to claim that Mark Shuttleworth fixed my laptop.
Of course, we all look forward to the day when that's not necessary and it just works.
Yeah.
So let me know how it goes.
And there aren't that many of you to go around, yes.
So can I just confirm, we'll be buying bar snacks for this party, will you, Mark?
I think it'll be a cash bar, but the company will all be good. And so I recommend that guys... get out and join us.
Excellent.
So the release is a great time for celebration, but it's also a time for us to kind of mark, you know, the full cycle. Our community is really big, and so we have tragedies during the course of a release cycle. And I heard just the other day of a community member here in the UK who died tragically in February. So I thought this would be a good opportunity to honor Lee Tambia for his contribution to Ubuntu. I know that he was a real advocate and a passionate sort of member of the community. And it's very, very sad to lose someone in an untimely way. But I think that's part of the meaning of community, right? This is a project which involves more than people's professional commitment. It's sort of an extended network of friends and family. And so there's sometimes that aspect of reality. So to those of you who knew Lee, my sort of heartfelt condolences, and to all of us who benefited from his work and his advocacy and his enthusiasm, this is a good time to remember him.
Well said.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
You guys do groovy work. I hope that the next couple of days of the release are all smooth, and have a very, very good weekend.
Thanks for coming on the show. It's appreciated, Mark.
Harlem and Peter from the Fresh Ubuntu podcast, which you can find at freshubuntu.org, asked me to go on their show last week, and it was really great fun. Nice to see how different podcasts are done in different ways, and quality turned out really, really well. I was a bit concerned about using Skype, but it actually came out pretty well. And we had a little bit of feedback sent here from David in Spain, which we got via voicemail.
Good afternoon. I hope this message is for Alan Pope of the Ubuntu UK podcast. This is David from Spain. I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed your contribution to the Fresh Ubuntu podcast this week. And and now in the process of downloading the first three episodes of the podcast. So nothing more to say other than good luck and look forward to some great content in the future.
Thanks very much, David. That's good to hear. We had quite a few emails as well following the last episode. David Godwin emailed in about the GUI versus CLI segment, and he sort of says, in the GUI, there's only one way to do something, and each option or checkbox normally has a help button near it and a short descriptive text, so there's no scope for mistakes. Whereas on the CLI, you're just faced with a huge sort of chasm of despair almost. You can do anything you like, but only if you know what you need to do. It's obviously very powerful, but David says, when you're feeling clueless, typing in some effectively non-English word with some seemingly arbitrary characters afterwards just deepens any feeling of helplessness you may have.
Oh, well put.
Yeah. We've got another one from Sepp in Bottrop in Germany, who commented on the show and the fact that obviously English is his second language. Quite an interesting point is that obviously he's trying to follow our English and he's doing quite well, apart from the last podcast. Obviously we're gaining confidence and we all sped up and he struggled a bit. So we've tried to slow right down on this one to give him a hand. But thanks for the feedback, Seth.
Yeah, the difficulty is when we're really getting into a discussion and we kind of forget our microphone technique and the fact that we're recording it for other people and just get into the argument.
And accelerate and accelerate.
So sorry if we do it. Keep reminding us and we'll try and keep it to a minimum. We had an email from Graham Bleach,
who happens to be sat here.
Happens to be sat in the room at the moment, asking who we're aiming the podcast at.
Graham happens to be here, so what prompted you to ask that question? What made you wonder what our target was?
I guess I listened to the first three episodes, and I was wondering if there was going to be some more techie stuff, because I'm quite techie. I've been using Linux for a long time and I deal with it professionally at work. So I quite enjoy kind of getting into more technical detail about things, although I understand it doesn't always work on a podcast.
Yeah, we had a comment last week, didn't we, from someone who wanted us to have some technical how-tos, Paul O'Malley contacted us, wanted some technical how-tos, and we kind of discussed it over the week, you know, between us, and we're still really twitchy about doing it because it's hard to do something that's not dry.
But I don't think that excludes technical discussions about things like firewalling and IPv6 and VoIP and virtualization and sort of things that, you know, you could really get into without still giving huge long command lines.
Obviously we need to keep a good blend of high and low level stuff for both new users and seasoned.
We should get some feedback really and find out what people want us to do.
We've put a bit of a constraint on ourselves, and it's been commented on actually, that we're limiting the show to about 40 minutes. So if we're going to cover things for everybody, you know, we're quite limited in that amount of time.
I had a message on IRC from Chris Oates, who's in the Ubuntu UK community, and we've mentioned over the last few episodes that we'd like some feedback, and we'd not only feedback, but we'd like contribution as well. And he wanted to know exactly what kind of contribution we want. One way in which we could get more contributions would be to explicitly spell out what we would like people to contribute. Do you think this would help? And if so, what should we ask for?
I was wondering if you guys could have a segment for people to send in their contributions. So you'd have a short slot and it would be perhaps a very, very short essay on someone's particular hot topic or a tip that would work well on audio. I wondered if that's a good way to stop, and they could even leave them as a voicemail perhaps, if it's a 30-second or... What's your voicemail limit again?
The voicemail would be quite nice to have a 30-second tip. And that would work really well. If someone's got a segment, a tip that they could give in 30 seconds, then yeah, call the voicemail number.
I think basically we'll accept any contributions, as long as it's of a quality we can put out on the show, you know, both from a sort of audio quality and a content. You'll have got the idea from the interviews and things that we've done and the discussion contents that we've had, the sort of things that will be good, but pretty much anything, tips, contributions, you know, whatever, send it in.
We've got a page which is linked on the left-hand side of the website. So if you go to podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, which is submission guidelines that tells you how to record something and some tips for getting the best quality recording, and send it to us.
Yeah, and we'd be really eager to help you out with that and give you any further advice if you want to help. Grab us on IRC or email the show.
I mentioned on the Twitter feed, which you can get to twitter.com/UUPC. I mentioned that we had a competition coming up. I also mentioned it on the mailing list, and a few people decided they would decide what the topic would be, which would be a limerick competition, which That's not what it is, but they're great limericks anyway. So we have a couple of limericks to read you.
So we had a submission from Josh Blacker, and his limerick was actually, "There was once a podcast by Popey and Davey and Simon and Tony. Though the contest was great, some said the music did great, but those complainers are just dopey." And he says to himself, it's actually possibly the worst limerick ever written.
I don't know. Well, not so bad. It's got our names in, so it can't be that bad.
Yeah, I think I'd go along with it.
Okay.
We have one from Sean Anderson, and his was, "There was once a podcast by Alan and Davey and Tony and Simon about a system named Ubuntu. Abruptly, Popey said, 'I'll have a bun too,' and then asked for extra cinnamon."
That really doesn't work, does it?
Yep. So I'm afraid, Sean, you don't win that.
Although he's got Alan's eating habits down quite well.
If you'd like to send your feedback to us, then you can use a number of ways. We have an email address, which is podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. We have a Twitter feed that you can subscribe to and send messages to, which is twitter.com/UUPC.
And we also have a voicemail where you can leave your messages at 0845 508 1986. And they can be up to 30 seconds in length.
And you can join us on IRC at #ubuntu-uk on the Freenode network.
Thanks to Ian Oswald from Show Me Do.
And Graham Bleach.
And also Mark Shuttleworth.
I'd like to say hello to Nicholas Lycoray, who came up to me at Log Radio Live in the USA and said he enjoyed the Ubuntu UK podcast. So thank you, Nicholas.
Yay.
That's about it for this time. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye.